The following podcast contains language that some listeners may find disturbing. Listener discretion is advised.
Hello, I'm Louise Steinman, curator of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. You're about to hear Mary Gordon, one of America's master storytellers, in conversation with author Bernadette Murphy. Gordon probes the lives of her characters and how the workings of the world, both enormous events and intimate moments, define and change us. She discusses her writing life on the publication of the complete collection of her remarkable short fictions. This program was originally produced on October 5th, 2006. Please welcome Bernadette Murphy.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here tonight. So tonight we're here to talk about Mary Gordon. In just about everything Mary Gordon writes, novels, short story, memoir, essay, or her recent work on the life of Joan of Arc, she plumbs the depths of the human condition, with themes of Irish-American Catholicism usually hovering nearby. Of course, I love that she tells part of my own story in what she writes. But beyond that, the reason I enjoy her work transcends the cultural and religious backgrounds we hold in common. It's more that she's unafraid to grapple with the conflicted, wounded state of the human condition that grabs me by the collar. Regularly, she dives headfirst into the muckiness of living, presenting us with a portrait of real life, the way the complexity of the public realm can clash and clamor against one's most private and innermost self. Gordon is a prolific writer, the author of six novels, a memoir, and a collection of essays, and now her short stories, 41 of which have been brought together in the stories of Mary Gordon. 41 of them. In all of Gordon's work, and particularly in these compelling stories, the contradictions run deep. On the one hand, Gordon brings an unsentimental presence to the stories she crafts. A sense of skepticism and cool-headedness reign in her prose. You will not find an overwrought character, a saccharine or syrupy plot, nor a protagonist speaking in exclamation points anywhere. And yet, through carefully limning the lives of her quietly desperate characters, she's able to transport us to great emotional depths. Her characters at times are devout in their religious practices, and at other times they're wary of institutionalized religion. And yet, either way, her work throughout reaches for deep and profound spiritual truths. She writes primarily about women living in the United States, but the shadow of a former existence, often in Ireland, follows these women around. They're neither of this country nor of that one, neither fish nor fowl. The same could be said of her treatment of class. Many of her characters hunger for respectability, the ability to hold their heads high and belong with the right sort. But even when they achieve this access, there's something inside them, an internal obstacle that holds them back, reminding them that really, deep down, they don't and never will belong. In her collected stories, we meet these contradictions as characters, as plot, as life. To enter her stories is at once a joyful and disturbing experience. Yet reading her work calls us to our highest selves, asking us to join her in the muck of life, as together we grapple with the very tension, contradictions, and wonders that make us all so terribly, wonderfully human. I've asked Mary to start us off tonight with storytelling, one of the stories from her collection, to give you a flavor for her work and to launch our discussion. It gives me great pleasure to introduce to you one of my literary heroes, Miss Mary Gordon.
Thank you. Can you all hear me? Thank you, Bernadette. I've done introductions myself, and they're a very difficult genre, so I realized the work that went into this graceful and and lovely and very insightful introduction, so thank you very much. The story I'm going to read is called Storytelling. I don't have a brother. What amuses me is that it was included in the best Southern short stories of a particular year, and of the ways I've thought of myself in my life as a Southern writer is not one of them. It happens to be set in Florida, which I guess counts as the South, which is why. Storytelling. I went to Florida to see my brother Ted because I was tired of reading and writing. I'd just finished the draft of a novel, a labor of 2 years. I knew what was wrong with it, everything that was wrong with it, but I couldn't think of how to fix it or even how to take the first step. It came upon me that I had misspent my life, all those years laboring over words, 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 and for what? What difference did it make to anyone? Who cared what I had to say? I had lost my appetite for telling. I wanted to visit Ted because whatever else shifts in my life, one thing is constant. I have always loved my brother. Is this really so unusual, or does it just seem so to me, that there should be a person you have loved and been loved by your whole life? What does this say, my finding it so unusual, about the age we live in or the way we live? Perhaps it isn't love I'm talking about, constant love, but rather constant enjoyment, which is even more rare. I guess there must have been times in childhood when Ted and I didn't get along, but I don't remember them. I remember always a sense of safety with him, a safety of a rather special kind, because although he was older than I, he wasn't the oldest child. Our parents had, in effect, had two families, three older children who were like aunts and uncles to us, whom we hardly seemed to know, who had moved out of the house and married before we started school, whose children were a bit of an embarrassment to us, and whom we embarrassed. Our parents were worn out by the time we came, and it seemed to me later, though it's nothing I would have thought of as a child, or even while they were alive, they died when Ted and I were in our 20s in a car accident. They were a little abashed by our existence, proof as it was of their untimely fecundity. They tended to us. We were physically well cared for, but they had no interest in our entertainments. Mostly, they left us alone. We had the orphan's luxury without the orphan's anxiety. We understood that our parents didn't think about us much, and so we couldn't go to them for understanding. Ted guessed, though I don't think it dawned on me, that our parents couldn't be looked to as a source of pleasure either. We divided the world up then into kingdoms or protectorates, of which he and I were in charge. His domain was pleasure, mine was understanding. That meant that the smooth movements of home life, that which made it more than bearable, decoration, desserts, no hurt feelings, no anger that lasted after sundown, were his charge. He made things happen, and later I would suggest what they had meant. He was popular in school, an outstanding social success, but his grades weren't good. I had no friends, but was valedictorian. So he went to a poor state school, and I went to Radcliffe on a scholarship. We were proud of each other in those years, but our orbits didn't touch. Happily, I watched him drive by in convertibles, picked up for tennis or for swimming by bronzed gods, their golden hair absorbing more than its fair share of light. Sweetly, every year he drove me to Cambridge in our sky blue Rambler, the only family car. Then after college, he came back to New York and worked for an advertising agency where he met Pete. It would be wrong to say that Ted came out to me. There was no need. That he would be with a man seemed to me unremarkable. That we would keep it from our parents seemed the expected thing. Pete and I liked each other. We liked to laugh at the same things, and we both loved Ted. Ted was 25 when they moved to Fort Lauderdale and opened a wallpaper business. They've been there ever since, 25 years. They enjoy their comforts, and I travel to see them when I want comforting. Their house, which, as Ted says, is a living hymn to wallpaper, looks over a golf course. It has all the things that I enjoy that I wouldn't think of having. A refrigerator with crushed ice that appears magically through the door, a swimming pool, a hot tub, a shower as big as my Upper West Side apartment. Ted picks me up at the airport. He takes my winter coat. You still own one of these? He carries my bag, complains about the weight of my laptop. We'll bury this under a palm tree while you're here, but I'm not going to even give you the time to unpack. We'll lock everything in the trunk. We're having lunch by the water. I want to introduce you to Jean-Claude. Who's Jean-Claude? Jean-Claude is an expert on bathroom lighting, particularly boat bathroom lighting. He works on our upmarket jobs. That's where he met. He's from Grenoble, if he's not from outer space. I'm never quite sure. There is something a little extraterrestrial about him. But as our grandmother would have said, he's good for what ails you, and at the very least, he's awfully pretty. He pointed to a table where a man was sitting alone, a man of about our age, 50 or so. He was attractive, certainly, but I wouldn't have called him pretty. There was nothing fine or fresh about his looks, and nothing girlish. His hair was thick, dark brown, with a few strands of gray. His eyes were bluish-green and gave the simultaneous appearance of being hooded and alert, as if he couldn't decide whether to succumb to something or to spring for its throat. His shirt was polo, navy blue, tucked into khaki trousers. He wore loafers without socks. "So," he said before I sat down, "you're wondering whether to start coloring your hair. Don't. I love the silver. It makes you look experienced. People aren't going to want to take advantage of you. But with that wonderful skin, those fabulous eyes, of course they'll be intrigued. And if you begin dying, it's nothing but an enslavement." "This is Jean-Claude," said Ted. "I'll bet you want her to color her hair," he said to Ted, "so you look younger." "I want her to start when I start," said Ted. "Edward, please, I can't begin to tell you the calamity of someone with your complexion embarking on such a course." "So you're depressed," he said to me. "What happened? Have you lost your lover?" "I don't have a lover," I said. "I've been married for 20 years. "And how old is your husband?" "58. "You need a lover." "My problems aren't about love. They're about work. I'm tired of my work." "I understand completely. Then you must travel. When I'm tired of my work, I go somewhere completely new. That's how I got to America." The waiter came by and took our drink order. Jean-Claude ordered Beaujolais Nouveau, which had just arrived that week. "Tell me about your coming to America," I said, recognizing that I was feeling curiosity. I realized how long I'd gone without. "Yes, tell me," my brother said. "I've never known." "First, we must take a moment to appreciate the beautiful young waiter. If you're young, you don't have to do anything. Just your health and your youth is beautiful. Look at the fresh color of his lips. Even his gums are beautiful when he smiles. Because everything of him is healthy. It says nothing will grow old or sick or dead." "How's Ray?" my brother said. "Terrible. Suffering. Dying." "Jean-Claude volunteers with the AIDS Crisis Center. He takes people to their doctor's appointments, helps them with meals. This guy Ray that he helps is, what is he, Jean-Claude, 23? You're very good to him." "Well, what I am feeling is it's the least I can do. It's my way of saying thank God when I am spared. I am not sick, and really I deserve to be sick so much more than these other people. I mean, I really was promiscuous. Not only that, I made a living of it." "Being sick isn't something that anyone deserves," I said. "I know what you mean, but I did all the things you are supposed to do to get it, and I'm spared, so I do this in gratitude." "You were telling us how you came to America." "Well, of course it starts in Grenoble. I'm a bastard. I mean, literally. Let's say that right away because it isn't something that bothers me or something I try to hide. It's like the color of my eyes, just something that's there that I was born with. So why try to hide it? My mother was very young when I was born, and she left for Canada with a man when I was 6. My grandparents were kind and good, but too old for a wild boy like I was. Probably now I'd be called ADD. I couldn't stay still in school, and all the teachers hated me. I was bored, so I made trouble to entertain myself. Doesn't everyone do that? Do anything to entertain themselves when they're bored? I swear people do the most unbelievable things because they're bored. I never had any teacher who liked me, not one. I wonder what would have happened if I did. That's why I've never learned how to read very well. Do you know I've never read a whole book in my life? Not one. And here I am talking to you, a real writer who's written so many books. But it doesn't matter, does it? Because we're just people talking, enjoying each other. It would matter if we were bored, but we're not bored, so it doesn't matter. I thought how odd it was that he was right, that it didn't matter. And that I didn't know what I felt about his never having read a book and what that meant about his life. I wondered whether or not I should be sad for him, and I didn't know why I was so insistent on intruding a note of sadness when Jean-Claude told the story of his life with so little self-pity, such an easy sense of once upon a time, and then this happened, and then that, and a peaceful sense of proceeding without thoughts of the end. Perhaps if some teacher had taken an interest in me, I would have been different. Now I make up for myself this story about a retired teacher who moves onto my street. One day I see her having trouble carrying a heavy package from her car, and I offer to help. She invites me for tea. She plays the piano for me. We become friends. I help her around the house. She gives me books to read and helps me with my reading. We go to the opera. In summer we go on vacation where we go to museums and read books in the hotel. But when I was young, I never met anyone like that, or maybe I wouldn't have ended up on the streets of Paris at the age of 14. But if I hadn't gone to the streets of Paris, I wouldn't be here having lunch with you in the sunshine by the palm trees and the beautiful green sea. Maybe I'd be a grandfather now, working for the telephone company in Grenoble with a fat wife getting varicose veins. Your legs are great, by the way. You still have a girl's legs. Why do you think you'd have a wife? I asked. Haven't you always liked men? I've had two wives already. Jean-Claude, said Ted, looking amazed. You never told any of us that. Well, all right, I haven't had two wives. Only one, according to the law. But I lived with a woman I wasn't married to for 6 years. This is incredible, Ted said. She had great legs too, but not like yours. Hers were very long, very strong, like trees. Like a man, and she gave great blowjobs, as good as the best man, which is very unusual. Most women just don't get it. We had a restaurant together, well, a cafe, more of a bar. When I met her, she was already pregnant. I went to the hospital with her. Her son called me daddy. She was a lousy mother. She started picking up men in the restaurant. Then she threw me out so one of them could move in. He beat her up. He hit the kid. The kid came to me trying to get away from them. I was living with a rich American then, and he wanted to take me to America. But I'd have given it up and stayed in Grenoble if she'd let me have the kid. She said if I ever came near the kid again, she'd have me arrested as a pedophile. I saw him 10 years after that. He was 19, a complete mess, greasy hair, missing teeth, sitting in a filthy hamburger place drinking wine. He already had a kid. We had nothing to say to each other. What happened with the rich American, I asked. I went to America with him, but it didn't work out, so I made my way to Aspen. I'm a great skier. Of course, everyone in Grenoble is, and I got a fabulous job with the ski patrol, with a lot of good tips from lonely widows. That's where I met Penny. She was a waitress there, and we got married for the green card. We were great friends, but the fucking was no good. I don't know why, because we really liked each other. How did you get here? A Cuban guy brought me to Miami. I learned bathroom lighting. Then I met George. I went home with him because he was rich. But even when I found out he doesn't have shit, I stayed with him. I guess we're in love. Maybe that means I'm getting old. I don't feel old, but I could never support myself by my cock anymore. That's over. Well, it's too dangerous nowadays, I said. What do you think about the waiter? Would he like to go home with you or me? Probably with someone his own age, I said. Are all your books depressing? Said Jean-Claude. I think I write about life as it is. Why would you do that? What everyone wants is to forget about it. Why don't you write something funny, something romantic, something about the waiter who meets his long-lost father, the oil sheik, who's dying and is going to leave him $10 million so he buys a house for himself and this older guy who's the love of his life. That's not the kind of story I can do. Anyone can do any kind of story if they want to, he said. My brother called for the check. He and I fought over it. Jean-Claude looked at the palm trees, or the waiter, or the boys, bare-chested, rollerblading down the middle of the street. On our way to the car, my eye fell on a dress in a store window, gray wool, sleeveless, a jacket trimmed in Persian lamb. Remember Grandma's Persian lamb coat? I said to my brother. You must try it on, Jean-Claude said. It will be very elegant for you. He was right. I did feel elegant, although it seemed odd to be trying on gray wool when 15 yards away people were dressed in almost nothing, in neon colors, their bare arms and legs absorbing the last of the October sun. The dress was more than I could afford, but I'd been working hard, and no one else I knew was going to treat me to anything in the foreseeable future. I shook off the self-pity that was ready to drown my sense of well-being about how good I looked in the dress. I looked at myself carefully from all angles, partly hoping that from one angle I wouldn't look good so I wouldn't have to spend the money or take the risk on so much pleasure, partly praying that when I turned I'd still look as good as I had a few seconds before. "Magnificent," said Jean-Claude. "Terrific, honey," said my brother. Jean-Claude came back with a black velvet and silk scarf, velvet flowers embossed on the silk plainness. He wound it around my neck. The dress, already a success, was transformed into something entirely other. It turned the dress from a success into a triumph. I looked at the price. The scarf was $300. "That's higher than I can go," I said, handing the scarf back to Jean-Claude, trying to keep my spirits from being daunted. I was happy with the dress, and Ted kept telling me I was doing the right thing. The dress was a luxury, but it was clearly worth it. The scarf might make me feel bad in the end. I knew I'd be happy when I got back to New York, but at the moment, all I could do was mourn the scarf. "You two go on ahead," Jean-Claude said to me and my brother. He caught up with us in half a block. "So," he said, "you're happy with your dress?" "Oh, yes," I said. "But you're sad about the scarf." "Well, it really doesn't matter," I said. "Bullshit," he said, and threw a small bag at me. I opened the bag. The scarf was wrapped in aqua-colored tissue. "Jean-Claude," I said, "don't be ridiculous. You can't afford this." "Baby," Ted said, "it's a lovely gesture, but you can't afford it. You're up to your ass in debt as it is." "Of course I am, you idiot. Of course I can't afford it. Do you think I'm an idiot like you? I didn't pay for it." "You stole it? What do you take me for? I've been many things, but I am not a thief. No, I didn't steal it. All I did was tell the guy that works in the store that you and Ted were married, but what you didn't know was that this would be the last shopping you'd do for some time because Ted was leaving you for me tomorrow. That I was terribly guilty, but we couldn't live without each other. So I told the guy who owned the store that he should give you the scarf because your life was about to be ruined. And by me, that I would buy it for you, but I had no money. The money was all Ted's, and he was a monster, but I loved him, and what could I do? So he gave you the scarf? Of course. For a while, I was trying to decide whether to tell the story as I did, or to say that you and I were running away, that you were leaving Ted for me because you loved me, and what could I do? I had to figure out whether the guy was straight or not, and I had to do it quickly, because the way I told the story depended on it. I have trouble telling which way these guys from the islands go, but I liked his ass, and I'm usually not into straight men, so I decided he was one of us. Thank God I was right. I knew everything was riding on my telling the right story. "Jean-Claude," I said, "you must bring the scarf back." "Of course I won't," he said. "Why should I? I earned it, and everyone gets something they want. You get the scarf, the guy from the islands gets something to think about and a warm feeling inside like he's the Good Samaritan. I get to give you the gift I want for you and can't afford. Only Ted didn't make out so well. But what's the difference? He's got love and money. Life is good for him. And one day you'll write something and Ted will be the hero of the story and you'll let everyone know how wonderful he is. Then he'll be paid back for not looking so great in my story. And one day you'll write something about me." "Jean-Claude," I said, "no one would ever believe me." "Of course they will, if you do your job." When we got home, Ted put my bags and laptop into the spare room, the one that looked out on the golf course. I said I needed not to be disturbed. I put the scarf around my neck, sat at the desk, and wrote all night. I didn't move until the sun came up, a garish red over the flat, prosperous green, where soon real humans would appear, to my astonishment, alive beyond the rim of my invention. Thank you.
That was fabulous, wasn't it? Let's have a second round of applause. I love that story. I love it. Give you a chance to catch your breath.
Oh, I got it. Thanks.
But it was fabulous. One of the reasons I asked for you to read that story was because we're here to discuss the writer's life, and it spoke to me about storytelling and what storytelling can do. And it reminded me of the quote or the phrase that fiction is the lie that tells the truth truer. And I'm wondering, you know, in storytelling, what is it we're looking for as readers, and what is it we're trying to give as writers that uses this lie to get to this truth?
Well, one of the things that worries me about the world now is that people don't believe in fiction anymore. The James Frey episode really pointed to that he wrote something that was a fiction, which he felt people wouldn't be interested in. Publishers wouldn't be interested in enough to publish it as fiction. Indeed, they weren't. And so if he said it was the truth, then it somehow seemed true. And I think that's so ass backwards. Because, you know, what's truer, Paris Hilton or Madame Bovary? Yeah. You know, all these reality shows. Right. Now, is that the truth? What can we learn from that? That has a resonance beyond itself. Right. And so I think what fiction does is, it sort of coalesces a lot of things. It makes a pattern of something, and so it has a kind of truth which is not factual truth, but it creates a resonance that sort of spreads out from itself and is very valuable. So I worry if we no longer believe in the power of the tale.
Yeah. I'm particularly struck in storytelling because the main character by the end of the story gets two amazing gifts, one being this incredible scarf, but number two being reinvigorated as a storyteller herself and to be able to sit down after sort of a time of fallowness and wrap the scarf around. And I love the final line. I wrote all night. I didn't move until the sun came up, a garish red over the flat, prosperous green, where soon real humans would appear, to my astonishment, alive beyond the rim of my invention. I mean, I just find that delightful. And
thank you. One of the things that's difficult, I think, for women, particularly for Irish Catholics, for Americans, is the whole concept of pleasure. Mm. And that we're an oddly, we're a consumerist culture, but we really don't get pleasure. And so one of the things that the kind of storytelling that Jean-Claude does is to create a zone of pleasure which is beyond the ethical.
Right.
I mean, if you want to say, is Jean-Claude an ethical person? No. Is Jean-Claude a life-giving person? Yes. And so I'm always very interested in the life-giving properties of pleasure that kind of almost make a mockery of the ethical world. And if you're trying to be a good person, it's hard to make sense of how wonderful these things are that don't have a moral valence to them. And, you know, we know these people who are so earnest and so good, and we can't bear to spend half an hour with them. And somebody who can tell a joke or sing a song or tell a story can make us feel, okay, I want to be alive now. Life is really worth living. So I'm a great believer in the life-giving power of pleasure, but it's very paradoxical to understand it if you're sort of worried about what is the good all the time. I mean, my husband once took a picture of me just to prove how much trouble I have with this. It was on Cape Cod. It was a beautiful day. The sun was shining, the sea was green, the sand was white and warm. And there's a picture of me sitting on the beach with my head in my hands reading the complete works of Simone Weil.
Yes, yes.
And my husband said, you know, I just had to take a picture of this because only you would do this. And we were swimming in the ocean one time, and I was asking him, you know, do you worry about the poor? And he said, you know, this is why people take bimbos to beaches with them. He said, because when you're swimming in the ocean with a bimbo, she doesn't say to you, what is the good? You just,
yes.
And
yes.
I said, but you know, on the other hand, if she broke a nail, she might kill herself. So,
yeah, yeah.
You know, it's not all
Well, it's interesting in the story because the narrator goes on to write, but it's with a sense of abandon and pleasure yeah. that she does that. So in a way, it's being dutiful, but it's also rediscovering the pleasure of writing.
Yes, and I think that she's given life by just the tremendous life, you know, this life force. These people that you meet that are just life forces are so precious, and we don't often know how to categorize them or to treasure them.
One of the words that comes to mind in reading through all your stories is disturbing. You put us readers in a position where we have to squirm. And there's a quote hanging in my office that I refer to regularly to remind myself of what I try to do as a writer, and that's to comfort the disturbed and disturb the comfortable. And I'm wondering how the role of disturbance plays into your fiction and everything that you write.
Well, it's the two halves of those quote. Whose is it?
I don't know. I have it stuck up. I have to look that up. But yeah,
are very very dear to me because one of the things I always want to remind readers is that life is much more complicated than we think it is. And again, I think one of the difficult things about being alive today is we're in the age of the soundbite, and everything is flattened out so that its contradictions aren't difficult. And I think great fiction, or the fiction that I aspire to write or that I treasure, always reminds people that things are a little bit more complicated than you thought they were, that things are themselves and their opposite and something in the middle. And that makes life difficult because it's often hard to know what to do then. But I feel like fiction is a great witness to the complexity of our lives. On the other hand, when I think, why write fiction, you know, in an age when there are so many terrible stories to be told, I think it is a consolation. Yeah. And when I think of what I go to for nourishment and sustenance in my own life, when life often seems unbearable, one of the things I go to is works of art and often great works of fiction to enter into that world, which is somehow more consoling than our own.
Is it consoling because it reminds us that as disturbed as we are in our daily life, that other people are disturbed as well? That life, if my life feels complex and I read in a fictional story something that is completely different but is equally complex, it makes me feel at home with
that? I think so, but I think just something that is formally well made is a consolation, that there is beauty, almost in a platonic sense, that there is something that exists outside and anterior to and posterior to this struggle that we're involved in, but the very complexity that then gets resolved in a formal way, if not even in a plot way, I think is consoling.
Just comforting in yeah. itself. Very cool. Another thing that I admire in your stories is that you're not afraid to let your protagonists look bad. There's two stories in particular in the collection, Cleaning Up and Walt. And for those of you who haven't read it, in both cases, they're women that, in Cleaning Up, there's a woman who has been taken in when her mentally ill mother falls apart. And as the story goes on, she goes on to take revenge on the family who had taken her in originally. And in Walt, it focuses on a woman who goes on to treat Walt in a really utterly despicable manner. And I'm wondering, as a writer, do you ever feel the need to sort of pretty up, like they're your children, and make them look good for the public? And how is it that you trust us to have the compassion that would be necessary to enter into these lives and not dismiss them, but to bring that to the story? You know, it must take a tremendous amount of trust on your part to believe that we as readers will be able to bring that to the story.
Well, I think of a lot of the works of fiction that I most love don't always have utterly admirable characters. You know, think of Vanity Fair, think of Becky Sharp, think of Emma Bovary, think of Ivan Karamazov, anybody in Dostoevsky, Raskolnikov. Some of the characters in Chekhov dramas are not, you know, you just paint, get your life together. And I think that that gives me the courage, that if you somehow tell the truth and tell it
well, your readers will stay with you, and that they don't, that it is dishonoring your reader to pretty something up. Yeah. So one likes to feel that one has readers that one wants to honor.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I was amazed when I was reading those stories. I had to go back to look at them again to see, why is it I don't hate these people? You know, that there's enough actions they take that I'm opposed to, but why is it this compassion is welling up in me? And, you know, going back and looking for it, and I'm not sure that I can underline the exact lines, but there's a sense of trust in me that I'm going to come to that conclusion.
Well, I think in both those stories, the women's bad behavior is motivated by shame. And I think shame is one of the really great fossil fuels that keeps the human automobile going. And I guess what I don't completely have the nerve to do is to create a character who does something despicable without any self-knowledge.
Okay.
So my characters tend to have self-knowledge. I think if I were really courageous, I'd have somebody unconsciously malign and not reflecting on it, and I don't quite have the courage for that. So someday, that's a challenge. You've just...
Well, I've laid down the gauntlet. I'd love to chat with you about the Irish Catholicism that runs through your work. It's so familiar to me, very dead on to my experience growing up. And I'm wondering why and how the Irish-American experience as lived in the States, the Irish experience here, is so compelling to you and so interesting to you.
Well, I'm ethnically a mutt. My mother was Irish and Sicilian, and my father was Jewish. But the community that I was brought up in was completely Irish Catholic in its inflection. And so I have Irish friends. And my upbringing is much more similar to someone who was brought up in Dublin in the 1950s than someone who was brought up in Nebraska in the 1950s, or even California in the 1950s, if they weren't a California Protestant. It was imbued in me. But I think what interests me a lot about Irish Catholicism in America is the Irish are such a blend of idealism and defeatism. And those are very un-American. And I think what I like about the Irish is they don't think every day in every way we're getting better and better. It's really un-American to sort of be in love with defeat, to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory, which is a very Irish thing to do. Never to be, not to expect that things are your birthright. I mean, you've lived in Dublin, so if you watch people on a bus queue in Dublin, nobody's pushing to get ahead. They're sort of stepping back, and you know, sometimes it takes 10 minutes to get on the bus because everybody wants everybody to get ahead of them. The Irish phrase, don't lose the run of yourself. You know, don't brag. Would be one of the, you know, it's kind of like arson in the Irish, panoply. So I'm very interested in that as un-American, as not presenting yourself, not pushing, having a sort of tragic sense of what life is, with a great idealism and a great musicality. Yeah. So that abutment of those two very different habits of mind is interesting to me.
My parents immigrated from Ireland, and I did live in Dublin in my 20s. And my father would always say, when I was studying literature, I remember taking a British literature class and bringing home some of the books and him writing to the professor, this is not, you know, the ones that were Irish writers that were being characterized as British writers he had a real problem with. But he would always say, you know, sure, no one suffers like the Irish. And he said that's the reason for, you know, the great literature that has come out of Ireland over the years. But in recent times, we have the Celtic tiger roaring. We have great prosperity going on in Ireland. We have a complete changeover taking place in the country as far as that goes. I'm interested in how you see that may change Irish literature, but more to the point, how that underdog spirit that has marked Irish literature has informed your own work.
I, You know, it's one of those things that is really obnoxious to say, I really wish they'd go back to their peasant ways and be a little bit poorer so that I could have literature. But I think Ireland is now part of the United States of Europe. And I think that another thing that will happen that I worry about is that because there was less emphasis on money, one of the most honorable things a bright Irish person of either sex could do was to be a teacher. And so one of the things that Ireland was able to present to the world was a fantastically educated population for its money because the teaching was so good. And the educational system was so good. And compared to us, they put a ridiculous amount of money into their educational system. I think that will change. As, you know, if you could be an investment banker and make £120,000 a year or a teacher and make 20, what are you going to do? And so I'm a little bit worried about what will happen. I'm worried about, there was a terrible story once about a true story about a town that had its own storyteller, and in order to appreciate him, they gave him a VCR and to thank him for all his storytelling. And everybody then came over to his house and watched videos, and he didn't tell stories anymore. So I just don't know what will happen to Ireland. And again, one doesn't want to keep them barefoot and pregnant to be exotic. And I think that for my generation, Irish Americans will always feel like the underdog. Now, for my children's generation, that doesn't exist because Irish people are as middle class as anyone else. And we have a whole bunch of other underdogs now that need not apply. And so I think that will change in America. But it really is, even in our generation, I think Irish have not taken, they haven't gotten the perks that they really deserve. I mean, if you look at, in the academy and the professions, Irish are not represented as much as they should be. So there is a kind of feeling of being an underdog. And I think that will last for my generation. It's over.
And does the underdog spirit fuel your work in some way?
I think it's always good to feel like an outsider. You don't have a place at the table, so you get a really good vantage point for the meal.
And that brings up the question of class for me. Class shows up a lot in your work. And many of the characters seem to aspire to a higher class. They want this other world, but they're always afraid of being perceived, as my father would say, as a lower Sablovian. that they don't want to be perceived that way, yet that conflict, even when they achieve it monetarily, that sense, that inner sense remains.
Yeah, I think that class is one of the dirty little secrets in America, that we're all supposed to be middle class, but we're not. And you know, I am not afraid to talk to anybody. I will say anything to anybody. But if I do have deep anxieties about the wrong fork. And because when I was brought up, there was one fork.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
Why would you need more than one fork? I think that class anxieties are very real. I think any immigrant group, any outsider group feels that there's some code that they're not quite getting, some kind of sweater that they're not quite able to figure out where to get, some way of drinking the water that they're not quite getting. And I think that those kinds of anxieties are very interesting for writing. But I think that they're real, and to pretend that we're all the same is to do a disservice to the reality.
And then I have a purely selfish question, which is your work often touches on the passions, torments, and even joys of motherhood. And as a mother and a writer raising children and trying to balance it all, I'm wondering, how does one do that? And it's a two-part question. How does one do that? Be a wife, a mother, a professor, a writer, is one of the questions. The other one is whether portraits of domestic female life is given short shrift in contemporary literature today. So it's a two-parter. You can go.
I think to be a mother and anything is always to feel like a failure. You feel like whatever you're doing, you're not doing enough of the other thing that you're supposed to be doing. So when my son was six, I always had an agreement with my kids that I was a writer from 9 to 1, and they couldn't have access to me those hours. And then I was theirs, and we were renting a house in Cape Cod, and I had a babysitter with me, and I was up in the attic where I was writing, and I knew my son was sitting outside the door, and I wasn't going to give in to him because the agreement was he couldn't have me till 1 o'clock. But, of course, I was sitting there like this and couldn't do anything, but I was going to be stubborn. So I finally came out at 1 o'clock, and I said, David, you're not supposed to be here. And he said, I didn't know you knew I was here. And he said, and I said, I knew you were here. And he said, but did you know I was crying? So, of course, I had accomplished nothing as a writer, and I felt that I was the worst mother in the whole world. Yeah. I will say that my daughter, who's now 26, when I was going through one of my guilt things, you know, I spent too much time, I shouldn't. And she said, you know, Mom, we never had problems with you when you were paying too little attention to us. We only had problems with you when you were paying too much. Okay. So I think you always feel like you're doing the wrong thing. And you're always tired, and you always, I always have fantasies. They're actually not fantasies. I do think many male writers that I know have women in their lives who just clear the decks for them, and they feel entitled to ask for those decks to be cleared. And I think the only way you get to do it as a woman is to be some sort of invalid. That, you know, if you can kind of get up and make the coffee, then you're in charge for the rest of the day. So I often have a kind of envy at men with wives who just say, you know, you're such a genius, it's an honor to be married to you, and I wouldn't dream of asking you to take out the garbage. Where, you know, as I always say, a bad mother is someone who doesn't hand make the Halloween costumes. A good father is someone who doesn't abuse the children. So the standards are very, very, they're very different. And I think it's very, very difficult for us. And I think we're very tired. On the other hand, I think I feel so lucky. I got to do the work that I love, and I got to have children, which I wanted passionately, and they were healthy and reasonably intact. So, yeah, I was really tired. I was really guilty, but I really got this great richness. And I do think that the experience of maternity has been missing from the great literature of the world. There are very few mothers in literature. You know, Medea is a mother in literature. Clytemnestra. Jocasta. I mean, this is not what we call giving motherhood a good press. And there are very, very few mothers in literature that are good mothers, and very, very little literature is written from the point of view of the mother. So if a mother exists in literature, it's usually from the point of view of the child. I think that particularly if you write about maternal love, that makes people very nervous. It's almost like you're sucking your thumb in public. So if you wrote something about, I hate my children, I really want to be running away with a man, but I have these ridiculous children that smell bad, people want to hear that. Yeah. But maternal love, because I think everybody knows how strong it is, scares people a lot. They feel very uneasy with it. And I think it's that kind of ferocious maternal passion is very rare in literature.
Do you think that has to do with the fact that because it is so present, or we're aware of how powerful it is, like Hallmark cards, like the beach at sunset, it's one of these cliched things, and it would be difficult to write about in a fresh way that it's so strong? Is that possible?
I think that nobody wants to hear about the conflicting nature of maternal love. That they either want it to be a Hallmark card or they want it to be Medea. Okay. And I think, you know, we have both in us if we are passionate mothers. And that complexity, that built-in contradiction is difficult for people. Yeah. And they don't want to hear about the passion on either side. They want it to be a pastel experience. And if you dare to make that palette a little bit more vivid, it's threatening to people.
Interesting. And yet
a lot of men will say, that's not my subject. I'm not interested in that. That's a woman's subject. And one of the things that men will often say to me at readings, thinking they're being nice, is they'll bring up a book and they'll say, would you sign that for my wife? My wife really reads your books. And I want to say, and what are you doing in your very, very busy life that you cannot read my books? Whereas a woman would never say, my husband reads your books without feeling like a jerk.
Right, right.
I encourage the men in the world to feel like jerks. I think that would be a really good thing. But I think men don't think that mothers and children are their subject. Mm. And so because a lot of women want to appear respectable in the eyes of men, they don't want to read about it either.
Well, it's interesting. We grow up as women, we're trained to read the canon, you know, and a lot of it is male stories, but generally there's no sort of training on how to read women's stories. Mm-hmm. So is it a cultural thing, you think? Or
I think it is. I think it is. And, you know, we do not value the female in this culture. We value the female seen through the eyes of the male, but we really don't value the female experience as it is an experience owned by the female. And you know, we can see this in all sorts of different ways, that the culture really rewards the female that is gazed at, not the female who is gazing.
I think we have time for one more question, and then we'll open up the audience for audience questions. So be thinking of them. But there is one that I want to get in, and that is in an essay that I read by you. You talked about as a child wanting to be a saint or a martyr, and preparing for the day you would get that call. And in order to do that, putting a thorn in your shoe to practice walking with this to see could you prepare yourself for it. And when I was reading that, I also was thinking about the writer's life and that we sequester ourselves away from the rest of the world. We spend a lot of time alone. It's very contemplative work. And in some ways, depending on the person, it can be an act of trying to redeem something about the world. Do you see some correlation between the vocation you've chosen as writer and the original vocation you had towards being a saint or a martyr?
Well, a martyr means witness in Greek. And I think that I am here to be a witness and to say what I've seen and to say it as well as I can. So why you have to kind of deny yourself the pleasure of hanging out and watching Law and Order or doing whatever you feel like doing is to shape what your vision is, and that takes a certain amount of self-denial. But I do feel that a writer who gets to be read by other people such as you is a very privileged person. And so, yes, there's a certain amount of self-denial that goes into it, but compared to people who really suffer, writers really don't suffer. You know, coal miners suffer, and migrant workers suffer, and people who have to, you know, scurry across the border chased by dogs suffer. And compared to that, sitting in a nice room with a window and a tree and enough food and people like you who actually want to hear what I say, I'm always grateful for my life. And I always feel sort of surprised and very blessed by it. But I think that, therefore, what I need to do to honor that good fortune is to be a witness and to shape what I see as well as I can.
So I guess what I'm interested in is whether the reaching or trying to facilitate redemption that a saint or a martyr might have it forefront in her mind, whether that is forefront in your mind in some of the writing that you do.
I don't think that I either save myself or save the world by writing. And I've told this story before, and it was very humbling to me. And I'll repeat this story. Some people have heard it. My children were very little. We were on vacation in island in the Caribbean, Tortola, and we were walking along the beach, and there were these little Labrador puppies, and they belonged to a woman who was running a lemonade and hamburger stand. And I said to her, "Could my children play with your dog?" She said, No, they can't. Get them away. I don't want my dogs to get used to strangers." And that's because of where we live. We live on this island with all these colored people, and I can't get them used to strangers because colored people are terrible to dogs. They like dogs to be as vicious as possible. Why, I have a colored woman who works for me, and her dog took the eye out of her grandson, and did she care? No, because that's what they're like. I said, "Bye, see you." The next night, all the electricity on the island was off, and only this woman had a generator, and so we were dependent on her for food and water. So we went down, and I looked at her palm tree, and it had a Ronald Reagan button the size of a pizza. And she said, "You know what was disgusting for me? The most disgusting thing for me as an American was that someone would think I would vote for a woman when Geraldine Ferraro was nominated for vice president. That was the most disgusting thing that ever." So I said, "Get me out of here." So I said, "I have to go with my babies." She said to my friend, "Oh, your friend is nice. What does she do?" And my friend said, "She's a writer." And the woman said, "What's her name?" And she said, "Mary Gordon." And the woman said, "Oh, final payments changed my life." After that, I gave up any notion of redemption of the world because I just, never know. And also people who read aren't any better than people who don't read. I feel like what I can do to deserve the oxygen that I take up is to do my work as best as I can, but I don't think it makes anybody else any better.
Okay, thank you. And thank you. And I believe we have a question over here. No, we have a microphone over here. Does anyone in the audience have a question? Well, she'll bring you the microphone so we won't strain your vocal cords.
How did you decide to become a writer, or when did you discover that you were a writer, and then what did you do?
I think that it was neither a discussion. Can you hear me? It was neither a discussion nor a discovery. I have no memory of a non-writing self. I learned to read at 3, and I was writing very soon after that. My father was a writer, and it's what we did together, and it was the only thing I was ever good at. And I was really a failure at being a child in all other ways. And so that was the thing that I did that made me feel good, that made people like me, that allowed me to be praised, and that made me feel good about myself. So there's no decision. There was no, agonizing. It was just always who I was and what I did.
Thank you. Another question? Good.
Hi, Mary. I just wondered, based on, how popular culture is going these days, do you think fiction is going to stay with us for a long, long time?
I think fiction will stay with us because it's one of the things that human beings do, is they create stories. I think literary fiction is going to appeal to fewer and fewer people because I think people's attention span is just going to get shorter and shorter. But I think it will always have its treasured audience. It may be a smaller audience. When you think of how opera at the end of the 19th century was the popular art form, and now it's a form for a passionate few, I think that's what's going to happen to literary fiction. But it won't disappear.
Hi.
Mary, when you were talking about the mother and you and Burnett, the mother in literature, I don't know, I just keep lodged in my head was Mrs. Ramsey. And now, of course, I'm trying to remember if she's seen through the child or if it's her point of view. But are you a fan of Virginia Woolf?
I did my dissertation on Virginia Woolf.
is not the right word. What are your the works of hers that have most affected you?
I would say to the light. You know, Mrs. Dalloway made me a fiction writer. I was a poet, and it was 1969. You can't get people to believe this, but nobody was reading Virginia Woolf in 1969. She was considered a very sort of doilies. Hyper genteel, people were supposed to be reading Norman Mailer and Henry Miller. So I found a copy of Mrs. Dalloway in a used bookstore, and I knew the name Virginia Woolf because of the Albee play. And I bought it, and I was working in an insurance company for the summer, and I was on my lunch break, and I read this book, and it blew the top of my head off, and I said, my God, you can write prose that's like poetry. And it made me think maybe I could do it. So Mrs. Dalloway, To the Lighthouse, The Waves, very, very important books to me. Everything that she writes is... I just recently, to teach, reread Orlando, which I hadn't read since I was in my 30s, and it was newly delightful to me. I think I'm now old enough to really get the play of it. But every sentence she writes is just so shimmering and precious to me. And she did get motherhood also into The Lighthouse. And to answer your question, the point of view goes in and out. It's Mrs. Ramsey's, and then it's the children's, and then it's Lily Briscoe's, and then it's the disembodied narrator. So there are many points of view. But in The Waves, the character of Susan says, henceforth I shall be hog-tied and bound by the beautiful and bestial passion of motherhood. And she really, the character of Susan really talks about that shameless attachment to the children. So a woman who never had children really, I think, got it. Colette writes wonderfully about motherhood as well, though she was apparently a terrible mother, but never mind.
You've described a great deal about how you were impacted by your Irish Catholic part of the family, your mother. Did your father's Jewishness affect your life in what way?
I think that my father's Jewishness gave me the sense that I had the right to speak and to read and to write, that it was nothing I had to apologize for, that I had a right to the life of the mind, that I had a right to take my place with people who lived by the mind. And I think that would have been much harder for somebody who was simply Irish Catholic, and also a sense that the larger world belonged to me, the whole world of thinking was something I had a right to take my place in. And also just a sense of growing up in the 50s, a sense of being somebody who could have been destroyed in the Holocaust. That was very real to me. As my father said to me one time, if Hitler's really alive and he's in Argentina, he's not really dead, and the Nazis take over again, you and I will have to go to a concentration camp, and Mommy won't. So that was how I was brought up. So. Good, alone at last. I finally get to have my father to myself.
We'll take two more questions.
Along with Tobias Wolff and Jeffrey Wolff, you too had a Jewish father who was a lying Jewish father.
Yes.
And how did having somebody who's, you're so impressionable, how did you deal with that, and how did that inform some of your work?
Well, I didn't know how much he lied until I really wrote The Shadow Man. And so I was in my 40s at that point. And that book was really a process of coming to terms with the fact that even though he did lie
the lying wasn't so much the problem as some of his ideas, which were really quite reprehensible to me. He was very anti-Semitic as a Jew, and that was what was harder for me. The lying would have been very forgivable. In the end, I felt that the tremendous love that he gave trumped whatever else he had done. That I had to witness it. I had to not say it was an okay thing to do, but I had to say at the same time that somehow my love transcended that, which it has.
Yeah. There's one down. Yeah, one last one down here. Thank you.
During the Big Depression, some great writing came out of the Big Depression. Now, a lot of us look at the world as in pretty much of a mess right now. Do you think some good, even good, I won't even say great, good writing will come out of this era of history?
I think there's some wonderful writing being done now. And I think that, again, what's exciting is some voices that were considered marginal are now being considered important to be listened to. And so that's a very good thing that's coming out of the chaos of our age. I'm not unhopeful about good writing. I'm unhopeful about the marketplace, but that's okay. In a way, what we have to do is people like us have to keep reading, keep our eye out, not be influenced by market trends or what's considered chic. We almost have to create a sort of samizdat for each other, where we are the ones that keep the good writing alive, encourage each other as readers and writers. And when I see things like people like you, book groups, there's still a hunger for it, and there's still a way in which we can keep each other alive, but we may have to be more vigilant and more committed.
Thank you all for being here tonight.
Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and is made possible through the generosity of the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation. Additional support is provided by Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, Navigant Consulting, the National Endowment for the Humanities, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, City National Bank, KPMG, and Wired Magazine. Media support provided by KJAZ, 88.1 FM, KCRW 89.9 FM, KCET, and LA 36.